Welcome to Conversations with Leaders on Tremendous Life Radio, providing some of today's most influential and inspiring leaders a platform to share their stories of growing up, what happened, and what they're doing today. Now, here's your host, Todd Weaver.
Welcome, everybody, to Tremendous Life Radio. We have another great guest lined up for you tonight. We have Mr. Jason Redman. Jason is a U.S. Navy SEAL retired, is a leader and a motivational speaker, and he's author of the latest book, The Trident. Jason, thank you very much for joining us in Conversations with Leaders.
Todd, thanks so much for having me on. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas to everybody who's out there.
Thanks so much. Same to you. It's really our pleasure. It's a real honor and a pleasure to have you on the show, Jason. And I'm taking time out, you know, with all the stuff going on. We really appreciate it. So let's get started right away. I always like to get, you know, some of the backstory of our guests. We'd like to know about your early memories, early years growing up, where you were from, things like that.
Okay, it was a pretty dark lit night that night that I was born, and I'm kidding. You probably hear that a lot, huh?
Nah,
no, really. Just my childhood growing up, I was pretty blessed with a great family, a very patriotic family. And just about everybody in my family had served in the military on both sides. My grandfather had served. My great uncle on my mother's side was actually shot down in the Pacific fighting against the Japanese. My dad's father was a B-24 pilot in World War II flying over the European theater and flew numerous combat missions, highly decorated, earned the Distinguished Flying Cross along with, I think, at least 7 air medals. And then my father followed in their footsteps. He joined the Army, and he spent, I believe, almost 6 years with the Army training soldiers to jump out of airplanes, and he was a rigger who also packed parachutes and airborne instructor during that time. So it was only natural for myself and my siblings to want to follow in those footsteps. I mean, we were raised in a pretty strong religious household and also a household that knew a lot about patriotism and service to our nation. So that, from a very early age, was the direction that I wanted to go. I believe I started out as a kid who wanted to be a pilot like my grandfather's, and then as I got a little bit older, I started to hear the allure of Special Operations Forces, the Army Rangers, and Green Berets. And when I was about 14, my dad told me about the SEAL teams, that he had put SEALs through some airborne training when he was in the Army, and what a great group of guys were. He said they were all crazy. He said they jumped out of airplanes and they swam and they blew stuff up, and he said I should start looking into that. And that kind of became my focus from about the age of 15. I never really looked back. I started to set my sights on that, and that's the direction I headed.
You know, it's wild already in your story, Jason. I mean, so many guests come on and so many people take a lot of different kind of paths, and oftentimes we talk about that, those real early years, that imprinting we get in the home. And so you saw a lot of, I mean, and oftentimes we're not aware of what's going on, you know, when we're in it. So we're young like that. I mean, did you really recognize the leadership, the things you were kind of being imprinted upon by, you know, your family, your father, you know, the whole chain of your family, really? Were you aware of that at all, really?
I don't think so. I think it was just something I grew up with. I mean, yeah. It wasn't, my dad never said, hey, you know, you need to go in the military. He wasn't this dad who, you know, had me up at 5 a.m. and kept me, you know, in this close crop haircut. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I've seen families like that too. It was just something that was there. It just, like you said, it just kind of happened. And I remember wearing some of my dad's old Army uniforms when I was a kid. I played Army all the time. He actually had an old parachute that they had, that they had gotten rid of in the Army, and my dad got it. And I remember I would play with that as a kid, me and my sister and younger brother. But obviously it impacted all of us because both my sister and brother went in the military also. My brother served 4 years with the Marine Corps, did a combat deployment to Afghanistan, and now he's doing great things. He's on his way to go into medical school. My sister is actually still in the Air Force. She is a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force.
That's wild. And it's just wild when I hear the stories. And with my own experience growing up, it wasn't quite take the same kind of path. But, because do you recognize, I guess the desire was there early and it wasn't really a sacrifice to be disciplined. And, you know, that a guy like the way I was thinking when I was young, discipline didn't seem like a good word for me. You know what I mean?
It settled for me only for the mere reason that I just set my sights on that, and that's what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, once I said, hey, I want to be a SEAL, I definitely recognized the things that I needed to do in order to achieve that goal. And a large part of that was, of course, the physical fitness side of things. I mean, I was never, it's kind of funny. I think the average person has this idea in their mind that SEALs are all these great big muscle-bound guys. You know, they get these images of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And, while we do have some big guys in the SEAL teams, most guys are about an average size, 5'10", 185 is about the average size for a SEAL. I actually am even a smaller guy than that. I'm about 5'8 and 170. So, but when I was in high school, I was even... I was a pretty small guy. I wrestled in high school, and 112, 119, and, my senior year, I actually wrestled 130, 135, but, those are pretty small sizes to get ready to go become a Navy SEAL. And I remember I used to get a lot of flack for it. I'd get people that would laugh at me. Oh yeah, you're going to be a Navy SEAL, whatever. And, that only drove me harder. It's both a strength and a weakness of mine. I learned later that at times, if not used correctly, it can be a weakness. This, I'm going to overcome and I'm going to beat you just because you tell me that I can't do it. And it was both something that played well for my future because I just, blazed my own path. But at times, especially as I got older, it began to become a, at times, something that hurt me, an Achilles heel. So, it was through my career, and, we can get into that a little bit later, but it really was, I started to make some pretty big mistakes. As I got older, I got a little arrogant, and, that tendency to just bowl people over if they told me I couldn't do something, that became almost a destructive thing for me.
Well, so, yeah, well, I guess, a lot of us can relate to what you're saying there, Jason, but, so in high school, you already had your sights set on SEAL, not just the armed forces, but to be a SEAL. So, and with your father in the home like that, and were you seeking out a lot of the counsel as far as what you needed to do? And did you do those things, like say through high school to be, become prepared for the next step?
I did. I was really blessed. It's actually kind of funny. So there were several things that occurred. At first, so I was about 15 years old and I started going out and trying to find things about the SEAL teams. And on, both fortunately or unfortunately, there wasn't a whole lot of information back then. The SEALs were a lot more secretive, and we'd probably like to stay that way right now. But, with the information age, there's a lot out there. But when I was 15, there was virtually nothing. And I searched and searched and searched to find stuff, and it was pretty hard to do. And I was fortunate. I had one of the individuals who was part of our church. He was actually drummer in our church's band. He was a big military buff. He just loved the military. He'd actually had polio when he was a kid, so he wasn't able to join, but he just knew everything about the military, collected all kinds of stuff. And he actually had some books that talked about the SEAL teams, and he loaned some of those to me. So that was kind of my first eye-opener into who they were and what they could do. And then I went down to the local recruiting office when I was about 15 and a half and walked in and said, hey, I'm interested in being a SEAL. And the guys took one look at me. I was probably about 5 feet tall then, maybe 95 pounds, and they pretty much laughed me right out of the office. So I didn't let that deter me, though. I said, well, you know what? Once again, I'm just going to come back and try this again. And I think they knew that they probably couldn't chase me out. So they actually had a video that they were showing back then called Be Someone Special. And it was a video about the SEAL teams and the training and what it took to get there. So that became another eye-opener, and I used to go back to the recruiting office on a regular basis. That lasted probably about a year. When one of the recruiters, they changed You know, they changed positions, and they had a new recruiter come in, and he was a salty petty officer first class. I'm sure he'd been out in the fleet for a long time. Pretty rough around the edges guy. And I came in once again and, you know, said, hey, you know, I'm just here to watch the video. And the guy was like, basically, hey, I'm not interested in you. If you want to join the Navy and do something worthwhile, then come back and talk to me. But if you're going to keep chasing rainbows with this whole Navy SEAL fantasy you have, then beat it and don't come back. So he literally just drummed me right out of the office. So I was pretty, you know, angry at that. And I actually almost gave up on becoming a SEAL. I decided to go join the Army. And this is where sometimes it's amazing how fate and, you know, the big man above sometimes can shape things. So what had actually happened when I went to join the Army to become an Army Ranger, I actually went to MEPS. And I was processing in, and I failed the airborne physical the first time I took it because of my I had had reconstructive surgery when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, well, you can't go up to altitude. You're not going to be able to clear to jump out of planes. And fortunately, my mom actually lived in the Virgin Islands, and I had been down there. I had done plenty of diving, so I knew I had the ability to do it regardless of what my physiology and my ear looked like. So that actually stopped me from joining the Army, though. So I went back and got a ear, nose, and throat specialist to check my ear, wrote a waiver and said, hey, this guy has the ability to dive and jump and do whatever he needs to do, and went back to the Navy probably, 6 months after I'd run into that guy. And they had a new recruiter in the office at that time, an older guy by the name of Henry Horn. And I've never run into Henry again. Henry was a fantastic guy, took me in and said, absolutely, you want to be a SEAL? I'm going to help you get there. And he, you know, always got me whatever information I needed. He helped me pick a job in the Navy. And that guy was a great mentor to me to get ready to go off and do what I needed to do to become a SEAL. So
that's a great example, Jason, a great story, you know, like the God shot. And you didn't know it at the time, right? You probably were a little angry and perturbed. Well, you almost did quit. It's wild listening to people's stories how, you know, sometimes so close to going a different direction, you know, and the universe provides.
We're just getting started, man. If you're ready for a God shot, wait for a few years later when I almost ended my own career, and it was only literally by the grace of God that that didn't happen.
Well, we'll get to it. I'm more than looking forward to it. I try to get the background and kind of a platform here to see how you know the path that you took and where you are today. So now it's remarkable to me also, Jason, that you had that internal drive, that the heart's desire, whatever it is you want to call it. I mean, you knew it. And I guess there was some ego there too. You kind of touched on that in spite of you, I'll show you kind of thing, but it did keep you going, right?
It did. And it, you know, it's funny. I've talked to some of our senior leaders now that I'm older and I'm trying to motivate and inspire other people out there, both for the military and now I'm trying to motivate and inspire future leaders. And it's interesting. At a younger age, I think the same qualities that make you successful and drive you forward, you know, you've got to learn when to apply them and when not to apply them. Yeah. And when we're young, we just have this tendency to just blast through. And that's exactly what I did. And it served me well. But as I grew in my career, I started making more and more enemies. And also, as I got to higher and higher levels of both, by the time I'd earned my SEAL pin, by the time I started becoming a junior leader, I really started to think pretty highly of myself, and really started burning bridges with people around me. You know, to me, the means justified the end, you know. So I would just burn bridges right and left, and just driving forward. And I was blessed enough to be intelligent enough and, you know, to be aggressive enough to be successful. But at the same time, you know, it's only years later that I look back and, you know, my successes were this, you know, battlefield behind me, or where I just left this path of destruction on my way to try and be successful.
Jason, that could be be a whole other show. You know, that humility piece is a tricky thing. I'm glad. I guess we all learn. Hopefully, we all learn eventually. You know, however we need to learn. You know, that whenever the shift happens, and hopefully you'll be able to describe that in your own, you know, your own path too. I wanted to ask you before we get you out of high school or college, or how did you? Was it the drive that focus on being a SEAL from early on? Did that? Do you, looking back on that, did that really help to keep you from, say, getting into a lot of trouble or getting caught up in a lot of other distractions, you know, growing up?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest things that I knew and I had been told through both the recruiters and through my friend from the church was, if you want to be a SEAL, you got to have security clearance. And in order to get a security clearance, you can't get in trouble. So you can't do drugs, you can't do all the stupid things that a lot of my friends were starting to do. And that was the biggest driving factor that kept me out of trouble. My friends would be out there, and I actually, you know, came close a couple of times. You know, one night, some friends of mine, I was about 17, I had actually joined the Navy at that point. I had signed up and into the delayed entry program, and you know, I was a pretty hard-headed kid. I got myself kicked out of my dad's house. My parents were divorced, and I got kicked out of my dad's house when I was about 17. So I was living with my sister and just kind of making my own rules. I would go to school during the day and work at night, and every chance I got, I would try and go out and party and have a good time. Smart enough to recognize, hey, don't cross these lines. You know, your future as a SEAL or to go in the military is dependent on that, but one night we went out and we managed to get an older of age gentleman to buy us some booze, and we're speeding around in my buddy's Mustang when the cops pulled us over and they found this booze in the back, and you know, they were they accused us of actually stealing it, and we almost got arrested for stealing. We managed to convince the police, hey, we didn't do that, we got somebody else to buy it, and thankfully they were you know, I think they were good enough that they allowed us to, they made us pour it all out, of course, and sent us home. But it was a close call, and it made me recognize much more clearly, hey, you know, if you really want to do this, keep your head out of trouble.
Well, I'm listening to your story, man, and I'm, you know, you are blessed, I'll tell you, to be able to pay attention like that. Not everybody can just, you know, change directions, or it doesn't even sound like you needed to change much of a direction. You were focused. So now so you get to the military, is it basic training? How does that all go through? And, you know, take us, we certainly want to get to the book. We want to get to, you know, the story of, you know, some life changing events. So, you know, you were in the military for 21 years. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And, I mean, you just don't start off as a Navy SEAL, I guess, huh?
No, you don't. I mean, but you go pretty quickly. I mean, okay. The SEAL teams are one of the few organizations that are out there that we try and recruit our guys right out of boot camp. And the reason we do that is to try and shape them from the very beginning in a special operations mindset. And a lot of the other special operations are starting to look at that. That's not such a bad model. You know, the downside of that is sometimes you get some immaturity. I mean, I definitely had it. I've seen a lot it with a lot of our younger guys. But the flip side, by the time that guy grows up, and when I say grows up, you know, we're talking mid to late 20s, he's got so much more experience having come in at this young age. And that's how it was for me. I came into boot camp, and one of the first things, you know, they ask you, hey, is there anybody interested in becoming a SEAL? So I got put into that program and started training, and I had to take one of the first things, and I'd been training for this in high school. There's a test you have to take, and it's almost no different than the same test that guys have to take now, and it consists of a swim, and then, excuse me, consists of a swim, push-ups, sit-ups and pull-ups, and then a timed run in pants and boots. And all of this is in a compressed timeline. So you basically have the amount of time to do the swim, then you have 10 minutes to change and be ready to do your push-ups, pull-ups, and sit-ups, and then you have 10 minutes to change and be ready to do your run. And that test was administered in boot camp. And I had been doing it enough that I was pretty confident that I would, you know, do well at it. And I was fortunate enough that I did. There was actually, it's probably about 10 of us that took that test in boot camp. And at the end, there was only two of us that passed it. So it was, that was kind of the path that started me and completed boot camp. I actually got sick in boot camp. I got mono, not by kissing anybody, but, just by, sheer circumstance. And, I was fortunate enough that it occurred right as we were going into a part of boot camp called work week. And, during work week is a time when the members of the company have to go out and do different jobs around the base. So because of that, they put me into bed rest for that week, and it gave me a week to try and catch up. And I kept going back, and the doctors kept trying to roll me. They kept saying, hey, you know, we're going to move you back to another company. You're too sick to go forward. So I would actually throw the doctor's notes away and come back and tell my company commander, oh, yeah, he said I'm good. Because I had convinced myself that I had to graduate on time so that I could get to my my training school, and then so I could go on to SEAL training. So I really drove myself into the ground. We had 3 weeks from the time I got sick. I just kept pushing myself, and that developed into bronchitis, which actually developed into pneumonia. So by the time I left boot camp, I managed to graduate, but I was a wreck. My mom picked me up, and I had lost a bunch of weight. I wasn't that big as it is, so I'd probably lost 20 pounds from being sick. And yeah, when she took me to the doctor, I actually, my right lung, half of my right lung had collapsed from being so sick with the pneumonia. So I spent my first leave cycle on all these heavy antibiotics and sleeping for almost a week and a half trying to recover before I left home and headed back and checked into my A school in Virginia Beach.
Well, and I guess we should put this out there. That probably isn't the recommended path for anybody that is desiring to become a Navy SEAL, right? Is to like throw the doctor's notes away.
Absolutely not. Yeah. You know, you got to take care of yourself. I mean, now I talk to these younger guys also. You know, if you cripple yourself or hurt yourself because you're not listening to what doctors say, you know, you're probably setting yourself up for more failure than you even realize. I mean, you could really hurt yourself in the long run where you're not even able ever to do this job.
You know, during that time, this just triggers a question for me, Jason. When, during that time, I mean, were you frightened that you weren't going to make it? And were you getting any counsel from anybody? Or were you just running with your choke out, full bore, not looking back? I mean, look back on those things and tell us, did you really seek any counsel from anybody? Were you talking to anybody?
No. I was driving straight forward, full bore, just blazing ahead. Yeah. I did that for many years. You know, it's interesting in life. You don't seek that counsel until sometimes you get a little bit older. And what really success enables people to continue to operate that way. Because if you have no method to take a look at yourself and go, well, why isn't this working? Then you're just going to continue doing things the way you're doing them. And that's why, over my career, and that's why in the book, I wrote a lot about the failures I had when I looked back, because those were the things that actually made me pause and look back and go, well, why didn't that work? But those failures, some that happened, I was just in denial at a younger age. So it wasn't until I got a little further down the road in my career that I really started to look back at all those things. And one of them even being that time in boot camp, probably, you know, refusing to allow myself to heal. That wasn't a very smart thing. You know, what did it accomplish? It made me look tough. It got me to end boot camp, but who knows the long-term damage I might have done to myself.
Well, help me with that. Now, that sparks another question. If, you know, as you're moving through the ranks, you're moving up in the ranks in the military, you seem to be achieving a lot of things. You're certainly influencing a lot of people. I heard your story. You started to recognize that if you can explain the shift in what's going on inside of you when you start realizing that, you know, you just can't keep living on self-will and pushing, you know, if that's in fact what was happening, you know, how did you start sorting all that out, let's say?
I mean, I started seeking, obviously, as I got a little higher in rank, and when we're talking, you know, E4, Petty Officer 3rd, Petty Officer 2nd Class, you're still at a very low level of leadership is the reality. In my book, I talk about, you know, at that level, it's just very simple leadership. You do have an impact on people, but for the most part, for us in the SEAL teams, and I think most of the military is like this, you're in charge of equipment and almost lower level peer leadership, as opposed to a little later in my career as I got further up and it starts to become dynamic leadership where you're really trying to motivate and inspire people towards a cause. And at times in the military, that cause is in the combat zone. So that's a pretty dynamic thing to try and motivate and inspire somebody when they have a high chance of being severely injured or losing their life. I'll put it bluntly, I didn't figure out what it was to humble myself and become a good leader until I almost ended my career as a junior officer. I continued as a mid enlisted member in the Navy to continue just to kind of drive forward. And once again, I think I was successful enough that it allowed me to do that. You know, and I heard rumors, you know, that Jason Redmond, he's a real jerk, from a lot of guys I knew beyond my close circle of friends. But, you know, we're all a bunch of type A personalities, you know, strong type A personalities. So I think all of us have a tendency, if you're not careful, to run through life that way. And I think most of us, it's when you get a little bit older, you start to look at that. So I didn't see it, Todd, until I almost ended my career.
We'll talk about that.
So as a Petty Officer 1st Class, I was selected. I put in for and was selected for a commissioning program. And the reason I had decided I wanted to go down that road is my father was an officer. My grandfather on both sides were officers. My sister now was an officer in the Air Force. And we were pre-9/11, and not a whole lot was happening in the military at that time. We were doing a ton of training, but real-world missions were very few and far between. I had managed to do one thing in my career. I did some work down in Colombia, and I talk about it in the book. We were advising and trying to assist with counter-drug missions. And we had come close to a firefight. The camp we were in had taken some fire, and we thought that that was going to happen. But it never really developed. But it did give me a taste of, oh, well, this is something real world, and I've experienced, and a lot of other guys around me hadn't. So I think that was just one additional thing that probably inflated my head. Once again, still good enough to lead and excel, but carrying that baggage with you. All that enabled me to get commission, and I did very well in school. I graduated with honors. I was actually ranked one of the top guys in my NROTC class. And I came back to the SEAL teams with this mindset of, well, I'm a prior enlisted guy. I just crossed school. You know, I'm Johnny Super Leader, you know. So I had this very false sense of arrogance and this false sense of leadership when really all I had done was simple leadership. I had yet to really experience that dynamic leadership yet. So I stepped into my first platoon as a SEAL officer, and I started school in August of 2001. And, of course, we all know what happened on September 11th, 2001. And when the planes hit those towers and they fell, I knew in that moment, as did some of my friends who were at school with me, fellow SEALs, that we were at war. And I went back to my SEAL team and spoke to my old commanding officer, and I said, hey, I want to get out of this program. I want to come back and be assigned, you know, to a combat unit. and a very incredibly wise, probably one of the more respected SEALs I know that's out there, SEAL leaders, he said to me, you know, Jay, this is going to be a very long war, and we're going to need good leaders. So you need to stay in school and learn and then come back and lead. And I wish I had heeded his advice and followed that, but it would be years later before it come to fruition. Because when I got commissioned 3 years later, the SEAL teams had actually gone through the greatest time of transition since prior to the Vietnam War. So all the tactics that I had learned when I was an enlisted guy before I'd been commissioned had changed because this warfare was so different. Both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, very ambiguous, very asymmetric warfare, fighting a very nebulous enemy. And it caused us to have to change everything we did. So I roll in as a brand new officer thinking I know everything. And suddenly I quickly started to find out I didn't know hardly anything. And that coupled with my senior enlisted chief, him and I just butted heads right from the very beginning. My arrogance coupled with he had a little bit of an abrasive personality. So the two of us together were kind of like fire and gasoline. Mm-hmm. And I think those things came along and were really starting to create some problems for me. And up to that point in my life, I'd never really had any problems. I had just managed to blaze through, be successful, and never have a need to look back. And what was starting to happen, I was starting to fail. We were doing very complex combat training operations at a much higher rate of speed than we had done in training, but because now we actually had been fighting against a very real enemy, we had real lessons learned, we had lost guys, it was at a much faster pace. So not only was I trying to learn these new tactics, I was trying to balance that against, hey, you need to be stepping up and leading. And instead of trying to seek counsel or anything like that, I kept trying to fix this stuff on my own. And I also started drinking pretty heavily, just to kind of numb the pain, I think. Mm-hmm. So all of these things came to a head on one of our first missions in Afghanistan. And I had probably already started to destroy my credibility with the guys at that point because of, this is one of the lessons, and I talk about this to a lot of people these days. You know, if you're going to be a leader, you have to lead always. You know, you can't just pick and choose when you want to lead. So during the day, you know, when we were training, I would decide, well, you know, I'm going to try and step up and lead. And then at night, go out and just make an idiot of myself. Mm-hmm. And you can't be a good leader that way. You lose credibility. You know, guys aren't going to follow somebody who can't control themselves at all times. Because in life, you know, your personality shines through regardless of what you're doing. So, you know, if you're hanging out with somebody in a sports situation or you're hanging out with them in a business situation or even a combat situation, you know, eventually their true colors will come out. So if you want to be a good leader, you need to be a good leader in everything you do. And that point failed. I failed to recognize that point. So I was really starting to hurt myself and never really saw it. Until this first mission in Afghanistan, had butted heads quite a few times, but it was one of the later missions that I made a bad call on that mission. And the bottom line was I just wanted to try and get into the fight. I think a lot of young warriors have this same mindset. They want to prove themselves. They've been through all this training, and they want to get into that firefight. And if I had managed to take a step back and recognize as a leader, especially a combat leader where men's lives are on the line, you have got to balance the mission against the lives of the men, equipment, all these other things. And truly the best leaders begin to understand that in warfare, and I'm sure there are many situations in life that are no different. You know, it's not only a decision of when to fight. At times, you evaluate everything going around you and you decide when not to fight. So it was on that mission that I probably should have made the decision not to fight. But instead, I took myself out of a position of tactical advantage with another guy and maneuvered myself down on to try and engage the enemy. And it was a terrible move. I mean, a very bad tactical move. And it actually delayed some of our other guys who were in a firefight getting some close air support. And it was during that time that finally our ground force commander got a hold of me and said, you know, get your butt up out of this valley. You know, you're delaying this mission that we can bring in to drop bombs or weapons on the enemy to save these guys on the ground. But because we don't know where you are, we can't do it. So I had to move up out of that valley pretty quickly, and we got back to the high ground and linked up with the other part of our force. But I pretty quickly realized that none of my guys thought very highly of anything I had done. And I started to hear rumors of, you know, Rambo Red and this and that. And, you know, a lot of people out there may think, oh, well, Rambo, he was this great guy. Well, in Hollywood, he might be. But on the battlefield, that's about the last thing you ever want to be. I mean, to be an effective part of a team is probably the most powerful thing on this planet. And if everybody does their part on a team, that's what wins Super Bowls. You know, that's what wins the World Series. I mean, it's an effective team. It's not one guy. And I was starting to recognize that, well, maybe I'd made some mistakes here. As with many of us in life, I instead of really acknowledging at first, I started to blame my chief. Because when I got back, you know, I was actually sent back at that point. And they said, hey, you know, my executive officer came and talked to me and said, hey, you know, that was a terrible call. You know, you risk guys' lives. You're lucky nobody was killed. I'm sending you back to the rear with the commanding officer to talk to him. And that's probably the biggest blow that any warrior can ever have. Any leader in the military. I mean, if you're fighting on the front lines and suddenly you're sent back to the rear because your tactical abilities have been put into question, especially in our community, this elite special operations community, it was a tremendous blow. And I really didn't know how to take it. I was kind of scrambling at that point, like, whoa, what just happened here? So instead of trying to take a step back and look at everything, I just started to blame my chief that we had that real abrasive relationship with. Went to the back, met with the CO, and basically tried to say, hey, you know, I was doing the right thing. I was going to help out the guys. And the CO kind of saw through that and was like, hey, you made a bad call, you know. Go ahead, Todd.
Yeah, Jason, what you're describing here, this is the internal stuff, and you're still, it sounds to me like, you know, you must be starting to be aware that, uh-oh. You know, something's going on. There's a conflict inside of you because I'm sure you want to be doing the right thing. Now you're denying it, blaming, you're a victim, all that stuff. So was there a catalyst? Was there one thing that happened? Did you finally like lay down and ask somebody, or did what changed your mindset?
No, it actually still took a couple more months. I really stayed in denial, and here's the other thing that sometimes I'm ashamed to think about. My task unit was part of Operation Red Wing. So we lost, you know, 19 guys on that day, June 28, 2005, and that's actually what I came into country on. And, you know, one of the first things I did when I was in country is the ramp ceremony to send off Matt Axelson when he flew home. And the memorial service for all 11 of our guys, because 11 were SEALs, and then the other 8 were Army aviation guys. So I actually, you know, at the end of this deployment, when that happened, instead of thinking about the fact, you know, instead of trying to preserve the lives and all these other things, I was still focused totally on myself, you know, my own arrogance and selfishness. So it was still months later, I went home. And to my family, you know, I had three young kids at that time. And instead of being thankful that I was home as opposed to my brothers that didn't get to come home, I was still in denial and bitter about everything that had happened. I, you know, said, I'm getting thrown under the bus. So it wasn't until one of my punishments was to go to Ranger school. And I headed off to Army Ranger school. I'd been in for 13 years, young junior officer. Nobody wears rank in Army Ranger school. And they had sent me there to try and humble me is the reality of it. And I showed up in probably the most foul, bitter mood, I've ever been in my entire life. I didn't have my heart in it. And I once again thought arrogantly enough that, oh, I'm a SEAL, you know, I'll crush this course. And it was February. It's pretty miserable down in Georgia in February. And Ranger school is no joke. Ranger school is a very tough school. And in that first week, you know, I was angry and still not putting my head into the game. And we did a land navigation course. And I had actually taught land navigation for a while in the SEAL teams. So I just said, you know what, I'll just blow through this. I had lost my way somewhere along the lines, Todd. I'm sure you're beginning to figure that out.
Yes.
I had thought so highly of my abilities. I was so arrogant that I just thought that I could do anything on my own and I'd make it work. And, you know, my castle built of sand was starting to fall down around me. And it was during that land nav course where I just kind of kicked the dirt and was like, you know, I'll finish this in a minute. I'm just going to sit here and, you know, just be angry for a while. And the reality is I failed that land nav course. And I checked back into the Army, and they kind of laughed at me as a SEAL who couldn't land nav. And I was so angry and bitter, I let my emotions get the best of me, and I told those guys, you know what, you can have this course. I'm out of here. I'm leaving. And in that moment, I almost effectively ended my military career, because that would have been it. Between the incident that occurred in Afghanistan and deciding that I was going to leave Ranger school, that would have been the end. So I one of the things I had to go do was meet with the commanding officer of the Ranger school. And he was a small, wiry-framed Asian guy, really pretty nice guy, very calm in his demeanor. And he sat there and talked to me about it. And I basically recalled the entire situation that occurred in Afghanistan. I basically told this guy, oh, yeah, I got thrown under the bus. That's why I'm here. And he said, well, is there anybody you'd like to talk to? And this, what did you call it? A God moment?
God shot. You can call it what you want, Jason.
Yeah, a God shot. So I said, no, there's not a single person out there I want to talk to. And he's like, you don't want to talk to your commanding officer? And I said, absolutely not. I don't want to talk to anybody. I said, just process me out of here. I'll go home. I'll get out of the military. And I said, well, I got one guy. He's a friend of mine. You know, I really would like you to speak to him. And I said, I'm not interested. And he said, well, his name's Vince Peterson. He's a captain. And immediately I knew exactly who he was. That was the mentor who had stuck his neck out me on numerous occasions, had mentored me. He was the reason I got my commission. He was the one guy that I couldn't refuse to talk to because he was almost like a father figure. So, yeah, he put me on the phone with him, and, you know, he was basically like, what are you doing, dummy? And I basically laid everything out. And for the first time, he said, you know, have you really thought this through? What are you doing? You know, have you really thought that you're getting thrown under the bus? Have you taken a step back to look at yourself? Have you ever thought that maybe you could learn something out of this course, that you could come back and be better? You know, one of the big things I was worried about was how guys, that even if I made it through the course, would guys still be able to respect me? Would I still be able to... if I tried to lead them, would they follow me because of some of these scars that I had created over the past? And he made the statement to me. He said, you know, you're so worried about whether they'll follow you. You know, you need to crush this school and come back and set the example and give them something to lead. He said, if you do all that and you earn back their respect, you know, they'll follow you because that's what people do. So it was a pretty profound, very quick phone call. And for that first time, that was the catalyst where I went back and kind of a funny story. I asked the Ranger captain, I said, hey, can I join back with my class? And he said, no. He said, you're going to have to roll back to the next Ranger class and start up with them. So you're going to have to stay here for a month in, you know, this Ranger Purgatory Holding Company, which I affectionately called Ranger School Jail, because that's pretty much what it was. We spent the days cleaning, and I spent a lot of days walking around Fort Benning picking up trash. And if you want to talk about a humbling experience, that was it. I had, you know, basically reduced my career to walking around picking up trash. But it was after that phone call, and it was during that time that I really started to recognize my own arrogance, my own bad leadership decisions, and how the heck I had lost my way so much. And really started to break myself down to the most basic levels of what does it take to lead? You know, what are those principles that men will follow? Who were the great leaders that I had worked under? You know, men like Vince Peterson and some of these other men that I had had the honor to serve under. And over that month period that I had a lot of time to reflect, I really started to recreate who I was and how I was going to move through my life. And in the SEAL teams, one of the slogans, or one of the mottos of being a SEAL, part of the SEAL creed, is earn your trident every day. And that, I really started to realize that that's the real key to leadership. You know, you've got to set the example every day. You've got to be humble. You've got to look out for your guys at all time and place everything about them and the mission and everything else long before you. You know, as a leader, you really should be the last thing that you're looking at. And this is something that we're missing in society today with a lot of leaders. I think they're placing themselves like I did for so long before the people that you're supposed to be leading.
You know, listening to you describe it, though, Jason, and we're always tough on ourselves, but it is, it almost seems like it's a human characteristic, and it's kind of subtle. You know, and you even said it. I heard you say, I just got so lost, so far down that path, you know, with it's no offense, but it seemed it's self-centeredness, you know, you're always thinking about myself. And that's a rough learning, you know, hitting a wall, or everybody describes some experience where they had to take a look, you know, it's an inside job. And the leaders of today that are genuine leaders, I believe, it's an inside job. It starts right at home on the inside. That's, you know, sometimes we can lead without saying any words. It's the way we live, the way we carry ourselves. I mean, do you see it that way now?
Oh, 100%. You know, it's leadership by example, and that's with everything you do. It's by leading always, and you're absolutely right. You don't have to say a word. It's all done by your actions. Your actions are the greatest form of leadership that there are, how you conduct yourself, how you do things. You know, if you're out there and you're showing people that you care, that you're doing these things for the right reasons, they're going to follow you.
And what about that month? You want to describe that? Looking, we call it inventory, you know, call it what you will, looking at things. All of a sudden, maybe you can describe this. You're seeing the world and yourself kind of in a different way, but sometimes it's a drag looking.
It is. It was pretty painful to look back. I actually describe it in the book as I cracked open the door to a room in my mind that was dark and a little scary to go into. But inside it, I saw a lot of the truths. I saw that I had been in denial for a long time about some of these things. And I had been going through life like a wrecking ball. And it was pretty painful to break yourself down back to that basic level and come to realize you're not as great as you think you are.
What about your motives? I mean, even searching our motives, my motives today, you know, looking at those things, I mean, did it ever, can you describe the shift to where you started thinking about other guys, like other people? Not, and I don't want to sound like you were so self-absorbed. I don't know. I didn't live inside of you, but you know,
No. That's a great question.
Bringing value to other people, like that's where the shift happens. And most of us need to get smashed before. That's a tragic truth that I find. Most of us have to hit some sort of what seems to be devastation before we look a different way.
Yeah, And you're absolutely right. I mean, that's what happened. And I realized, I mean, when I went through, when I started ranger school the first time, I was so focused on myself, I could care less about the guys around me. And ranger school is a leadership school. That is the founding core of it. And they put you in situations and they try and make you as miserable, cold, tired, really restrict the amount of food that you eat to make you as uncomfortable as possible. And that's when you really learn how to lead. But in order to do that, you've got to be looking out for the guys around you. You've got to be able to motivate and inspire them and encourage them. And I didn't do that the first time. And I realized in that month that I was there in Ranger School Jail that that I had those skills. I had learned them before. I'd been through all this kind of training. I'd seen it in BUDS. You know, I'd been through some very hard training in the SEAL teams. I knew how to be a leader. I just needed to step up and do it. So it was a mental commitment that I was going to overcome this and that I was going to come back in this next course that I was starting with my sole goal of trying to help the guys around me, trying to be a good leader, setting an example, and just doing the right thing at all the time, all the different times in training.
Did it ever cross your mind like, what a great opportunity to be a power of example. I can come back here. I can come back and I'm the guy that failed Ranger School. You know, what better leader, you know, what better example can you have, right? But you didn't think of it like that for a while, huh?
Yeah, I didn't at first, but it definitely came back. Well, it's funny. Yeah. I mean, that really became the genesis of the book. I mean, the book, if nothing else, it is a story of redemption, because fast forward, successfully graduated Ranger School. I was actually ranked at the very top of the class. I mean, I might have had the opportunity to even be an honor man, but I came to find out that if you get rolled back, you're not eligible. But still left there on a very high note. But I didn't have a big head about it. I came back and I recognized that that was just one accomplishment. You know, it didn't do anything for me aside from teaching me that I had the ability to lead and do a good job again. So I came back to my SEAL team, a very, very humble man, and recognizing that I still carried all those scars that had occurred from that negative deployment in Afghanistan. And I just stepped into it. My goal was every day to set the example in training. Whatever we were doing, I was going to stay humble. And if I didn't have the answer, if I was unsure of something, I wasn't going to try and figure it out on my own. I had all these experienced guys around me. Experienced leaders, experienced enlisted members, smart guys. So I'd ask them. I was much more open-minded. I was much more cognizant of everything going around going on around me. And that led to go ahead, sorry.
No, it's good to hear. I'm chuckling because I can relate with it so much, not in the military aspect, but in other areas of my life. You know, I got how to get my mind pried open almost. You know what I mean? I couldn't open it up myself.
Yeah, I needed mine to be almost cracked like a walnut.
Well, moving forward then, now, so you're back into things are different inside of you, and you see that. I heard you say you were asking guys around you. All of a sudden, there is more of a team kind of atmosphere around. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, from your own mind, that's how you see it now. So what happened? I want to move forward. Time goes so fast, Jason. I apologize. You were wounded, severely wounded in 07, correct?
I was. So I'll just say just real quickly about that. Deployment, that workup to get ready to go to combat,
yes.
And that deployment cycle. By humbling myself, I earned back the trust of the guys, and it was an amazing thing, and I recognized it, and it was just this incredible point of redemption. But it also made me stay very humble, because I recognized I never wanted to go through that journey again, to be broken down to that most basic level and face failure like that. So it kept me in check and went on to this very, very successful Iraq deployment. And at the very end of that deployment, in a very large firefight, I was wounded pretty severely. I was hit at least 8 times that we're aware of between my body and body armor and helmet. And I took 2 rounds in the left elbow, and I took a round in the face. And it's interesting, because that actually started another journey of leadership and understanding myself. There was a little more reflection that went into that. It's everybody in life makes mistakes that you either crumble to or you have to overcome. And then everybody in life has suffered some level of catastrophic event, whether it's a lower level, like maybe you lost a job, all the way to the highest level of severe injury or a chronic disease, or maybe you lost a loved one. But it's at that point in your life that there are also different levels of leadership. You know, you can lead from any situation, and you see it. There's some people that allow those moments in their life to destroy them, and they don't step up, and they just... they get miserable and they turn inward and they really allow their life to just kind of fall apart, and they drag a lot of people down with them. And then we've all met those other people that have come across these moments and they just say, you know what, I'm going to refuse to give into that. I'm going to step up. I'm going to stay positive. I'm going to lead people around me. And it makes not only things better for them, but it makes things better for everybody around them. And that was the path that I decided, because I had already been down the long, dark path. I said, hey, you know, this is nothing more than, you know, what you went through before was hard and devastating, and this is no different. So just drive forward and set the example, raise up people around you, and put one foot in front of the other. And that's how I chose to walk down that path after I got wounded.
Well, Jason, I know I rifled you through some years pretty quick there, but can you see, you obviously are talking about it now, you can see how all those experiences that seem negative and so bad or demeaning or whatever the words are, there's value in all that stuff. And I guess it's good you had all those earlier experiences, because now there you are in the hospital, and now you know you can persevere, you know you can do it.
Absolutely, Todd. You know, I've told a lot of people this, that I'm not sure if I hadn't gone through that dark period where I had to really learn who I was and what I was made of and what it is to lead and be humble and overcome, you know, tremendous adversity, if I would have been mentally prepared to be wounded in the manner that I was. But because I went through that, it only took about a week, maybe a week and a half, before I said, okay, can't go back and change the past. All I can do is drive forward and shape the future, and I'm going to make my future bright.
Well, that I wanted to ask you about the note, and that kind of explains some of it, you know. So, but inside, it sounds like you are now inside of you. You know that you can be a positive influence of change no matter where you are. So you've learned that somewhere along the line. I don't know if you wrote it down, but so the note on the door, the note on the hospital door, you know. Don't come in here if you're going to feel sorry for me, or go elsewhere. You know, talk about some of that.
No, you're exactly right. It was right during that time. It was about a week to a week and a half that I had been in the hospital, and I had already started to figure out the power of staying positive and lifting up the people around me. And I didn't want sympathy. I wasn't sorry for myself. What happened, it happened. I couldn't change it. So the only thing I could do is drive forward. And I had some people that came into my room, and they were, you know, there was kind of an air of pity in their voices, the way they talked about my injuries and how all of it had happened. And I just kind of felt like they were really feeling sorry for me. They were feeling a lot of pity. And when my wife came back, I didn't have the ability to talk. All I could do was write because of my facial damage. And I wrote down to her, I said, never again is somebody going to come into my room like this. You know, I don't feel sorry for myself. I don't want anybody else to feel sorry for me. And I penned out that note in one shot. I didn't give it any thought. I just wrote it out. It was actually originally on just an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. And I told my wife, I said, hey, go post this on the door. And she looked at me like I was crazy. And I said, please just do it. So she did. And I, you know, had her tell all the nurses to make sure anybody that came into my room read it. A couple of days later, somebody else came in, and they were a little sad and, you know, kind of feeling down over my injuries. And I asked my wife, I said, hey, can you go find me another piece of paper, you know, something big and bright, like poster size? And she went down to the store and found a large orange piece of paper, and we transcribed the sign on the door right onto that, and stuck it on the door. And probably a day or two later, a fellow SEAL slapped his trident into the bottom of the sign, And it went viral from there.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, we could do a whole show just on the note, you know, the things that are going on inside of you, inside of all of us. I mean, for God bless us, for some of us, you know, you go visit someone that's sick or, you know, we talk to someone that's, you know, really in a bad way. And I can even make that about me. You know what I mean? Like talk about self-centered. I mean, you know what I mean? We don't know what to say to somebody. We're more uncomfortable than the person in the hospital bed.
It is true. And now that I'm on the other side, I recognize that for people. Mm-hmm. You know, the flip side, I'd love to tell people, because now I work with so many wounded warriors and families of the fallen. And if you can push down that awkward moment where you're uncomfortable and just put it behind you, just stay positive, they're going to feed off that. You know, what I like to tell people about that sign that I wrote is 80%, probably greater than 80% of the wounded warriors that you'll ever meet have that same attitude. You know, and everybody tries to make a big deal out of the fact that I wrote it, but really all I managed to do was capture the spirit of all those guys in writing. And I think it's that way with most people out there who something happens to them. If you can be positive around them, it's only going to help lift them up. Not always. I mean, some people really struggle, but even then, even more so is a time to try and put away your own awkwardness. I mean, that's a great moment to try and lead and help.
Well, what came next then, Jason? I mean, when you left the military, you're like crazy decorated. I mean, you really served this country and served all of us very well. Even if it may be early on at times, maybe your motives weren't the most spiritual, but I mean, everything worked out the way it did. What came first after that? Was it, did you have a desire? Where did Wounded Wear, that idea come from? Was it there and then the book, or was it the book and then Wounded Wear? How did those kind of things come about?
No, it was Wounded Wear first. The book came later, and the book, Wounded Wear first was it kind of interesting. I mean, I'd love to say that everything was roses all along the way, but that's not reality. I mean, I had hard days. I mean, there were days that I woke up and I just thought to myself, am I ever going to be normal again? Are they ever going to be able to put me back together? I had a lot of bad infection problems, which is very common with wounded warriors because battlefield injuries are very dirty. Mm-hmm. And that was a real struggle. At times, but once again, I recognized, hey, you know, if you start to feel sorry for yourself and if you start to feel bad, then, you know, you're setting a bad example for other guys out there. You know, get out there and be positive and, you know, help out these other guys. I've met so many other wounded warriors who had, you know, severe injuries. I mean, multiple amputations and burns. I mean, just made me say, who am I to sit here and feel sorry for myself? You know, let's drive on. So that, during that process of almost 4 years of surgeries, you know, 37 surgeries, which sounds like a lot, but there are a lot of guys out there that have had more. But there was during that time that I had a lot of people who failed to recognize. They would stare at me a lot. I'd go to all these different places. And granted, in the beginning, I looked pretty rough. I was missing my nose, cheekbone. My face was in pretty bad shape. I was pretty disfigured in the beginning. And, you know, it attracted a lot of attention. And to be honest, it actually made me angry at times. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the biggest question that any wounded warrior and that any of the family of the fallen asked themselves is, was my sacrifice worth it? Do my fellow citizens recognize the sacrifice I've made for the freedom of this nation? And I was, you know, at times I began to question that just because I felt much more of a freak than a warrior who had gone out to try and fight against a very real and very violent enemy to our nation. And it was during one of those times that somebody was staring at me that I got tired of it. And I came home and I made a shirt and it said, you know, stop staring and just say thank you. And on the back, I had an American flag and I wrote Wounded Wear. And I started wearing that shirt. I made some other ones that were a little more in your face, like stop staring. I got shot by a machine gun. It would have killed you. So it was, you know, just a little more inflammatory rhetoric. And my, you know, I had friends that say, you should do something with this. And my wife said, you know, they're right. We should do something with this. You're not the only warrior who feels this way. You know, let's tone down the rhetoric and let's come up with some cool slogans and start doing this. And that's how Wounded Warrior was created. We came up with the slogans of scarred so that others may live free, forever recognizing the cost of freedom, and what have you done for your country lately? Mm-hmm. And that became the genesis for Wounded Warrior. And since then, that was in late 2008, going into 2009, we now have grown into an organization that is providing clothing and clothing kits across the country. We're averaging $400 worth of clothing and T-shirts and jackets and shorts and things that make Wounded Warriors' lives better based directly off the experience I had as a Wounded Warrior, to doing clothing modifications, to doing empowering events like we take Wounded Warriors and Families of the Fallen skydiving, bring them together in social events, and that's how Wounded Warrior came to be.
And anybody listening want to get over to Wounded Warrior, it is woundedwear.org, correct? That's where they can find out everything. But I was over there looking. It looks, it's really cool. I see a picture of you skydiving there.
Yeah. I actually got disqualified skydiving while I was in the military because of my arm injury. But the way a civilian parachute works is different from how a military parachute works. So after I got out, I requalified, and it's been great. And like I tell a lot of people, I tell Wounded Warriors this and Families of the Fallen that jump, it's not really about jumping out of the plane, or it's not really about skydiving. A lot of people get this idea, oh, I could never do that. But what I tell a lot of people, and I encourage people now, get out and jump out of a plane, get out and climb a mountain. That's part of living greatly. And the biggest thing about that is when you step off the end of the ramp out of that plane, it's not really the act of skydiving. It's more so of letting go of your fears and understanding that you're still alive. And it just gives you this power, and we've seen it with these Wounded Warriors, these guys who thought, you know, I could never do anything again, to suddenly now, I mean, we've jumped quadruple amputees, we've jumped flying Wounded Warriors, we've jumped Families of the Fallen who have lost a loved one on the battlefield, and they come down and they're like, I can do this, I can overcome, I can live life greatly.
It's wild listening to you, Jason. I mean, the transformation in your, you know, just from hearing your story in this short amount of time so far, you know, the transformation of you being others' focus now and really thinking about bringing value to other people and the families of the fallen and raising the awareness of all those things, it's wild. So there's been a lot of changes that have gone on inside of you through the years, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Amen to that.
Yeah. Now, well, it sounds great. And again, anybody that wants to help out or get over there and see what's going on and become more aware of what's happening for all the fallen warriors and their families, it's woundedwear.org. Tell us about the book. Were you having coffee one day and someone said, hey, Jay, you ought to write a book, or how did the book come about?
I mean, I had heard that a few times. People had said, yeah, you should write a book. And I have always written. I've written everything from poetry to short stories. Just, I've always liked to write. But the SEAL teams were... Although we've had a lot of exposure in the last several years, within the core of the SEAL teams, we're still not big fans of the publicity. Mm-hmm. And I really had already done so much to, at first, damage my reputation, to having come full circle to earn back the trust and the respect of the community, that the last thing I ever even wanted to consider was trying to write a book. I mean, we really, unfortunately, look at some of the guys in our community that have done that. You know, we're not that big fans of that. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the big slogans in the SEAL teams is the deed is all, not the glory. And I know that's right now we're seeing a lot of publicity. So what happened is in all these surgeries, I actually was doing what I've always done. I started writing and I really started to reflect. You know, we didn't have too much time to get into it, but that moment on the battlefield when I almost bled out, I literally felt death. It's a very physical thing. And, it was in that moment that I thought my time was at hand. And thankfully, God gave me a second chance. And I view that now as this amazing opportunity to never take it for granted, to try and spend this time with my family, to try and honor the men who didn't get to come home, who didn't get a second chance. And I just started to reflect on all that. I started to reflect on all those lessons that you and I have talked about today. And I really started to recognize there was a lot of power in them. I think there's a lot of books out there by leaders who talk about all their successes. That's their story. And that's great. But the reality is almost all of us, and me especially, I learned my greatest lessons during my hardest falls. And that's why I thought that writing this book this way was probably the best thing. So I'd written about 20 chapters and I'd showed them to a couple of friends and they were like, wow, you really got to do something with this. So I took it to some of the SEAL leadership and I said, hey, I know we're not real big fans of books, but I wanted to show you what I've been writing and what I'm thinking about. Would this be a good reflection of our community? Do you feel that it's good, a good lesson? You know, it's a good message. And unequivocally, they started passing it around the leadership and up the chain of command. And they all said, Jay, absolutely, you should do this. So that's how we started moving forward with it. And that's how it really grew into a book. Fortunately, I had the opportunity. I was starting to get pretty busy. I thought I needed some help. So I got linked up with John Bruning, who is a great author, wrote a lot of World War II history and started writing about some modern post 9/11 things. And John and I just became a really great team. He really brought a lot of the structure to the story. And he also brought out some more of the details and I think a little bit deeper even of an emotional context. And the other part of the book that started to develop was my relationship with my wife. Because through all these stories that I've relayed to you tonight, she never wavered. She always, you know, stood beside me and behind me and, you know, sometimes dragged me along. You know, regardless of, you know, the immaturity and at times the arrogance when I was younger and then to be severely wounded and her to take care of me, it truly showed me what true unconditional love is. So that's as much a part of the book as everything else. So what I'm telling people now is, I mean, if you're looking for a book that's got combat in it, this has got it. If you're looking for a book that is motivational and inspirational, this book has it. If you're looking for a book on leadership and overcoming adversity, that's the heart and soul of this book. And then last, it's a love story. You know, it follows the journey of my wife and the strength of true love, which I firmly believe exists. And I feel that, you know, there's a lot of people who we're starting to get in this day and age where, what, we're over a 50% divorce rate now. And I think too many people are willing to throw away their relationships when things get hard. And I think my wife and I are living proof to, if you're willing to stay the course and struggle through those hard times, you know, through sickness and in health, that makes the power of a good relationship. And that's the story, you know, that's the baseline of the book. And the reviews have been pretty phenomenally reflecting that.
Good for you, man. The books of the tried. And that, Jason, your story is just really, you know, it's funny here at the end you talk about, you sought some counsel with the book, you know what I mean? Like, so now that's ingrained in you, you know better than to, you know, that Lone Ranger thing only works so long, like you said. They're hard lessons to learn, and we really appreciate you sharing them all with us. You know, there's, you know, your own personal journey, your own path. And I happen to like people that talk about things that when they fell down, because that's really, like you said, I'm sure that's where the lessons are learned. You know, if everything's going good, I know myself, I don't learn so much. It's when there's challenges. And your story is nothing but, it's never quitting, never giving up, you know, full steam ahead, you know, the drive, the discipline, the focus and change, you know, and that's what it's about, man. I love it.
Well, thank you. Yep. I've been very blessed, and it's just, it's a story that I think, everybody, and that was one of the biggest things we wanted to do. We wanted to make it relatable. You know, The lessons that I learned happened to occur while I was a Navy SEAL, but they could have occurred to anybody. They could have occurred to a business leader. that could have occurred to an electrician. It doesn't matter. I mean, you know, regardless of anything, we're all human. We all have to lead. We all make mistakes and have to overcome them. We all suffer extreme levels of adversity. And that's what I wanted people to get out of this book. And, you know, if it's entertaining along the way, which most people say it is, then I think that's an added bonus.
Good for you, Jason. We appreciate your time so much, not just tonight, but I really want, you know, I thank you so much for your sacrifice, your commitment. I'm glad you're learning the lessons. You've learned the lessons you've learned so far, all of them, you know, and continue to bring a lot of value to a lot of the people. And I hope you just continue to share your story and your experience, because that's, you change on the inside, and that's really what true leadership is, I believe.
I agree. Well, thank you, Todd. It's been awesome. Thanks for allowing me to come on and share my story. I hope a lot of people out there, you know, there's a lot of more fine details in the book. So,
yeah, we got to get the book. There's no doubt about it. Everybody, please get the book. And I know there's so much involved in this story. Maybe we'll get you back on again. We'll focus maybe more on one of those transformations, one of those inventories. Okay. I really appreciate it, James.
Todd, thank you. I'd be honored to be back on again.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure and our honor. And please thank your wife and your family, the kids and everybody, for giving you up for an hour or so. Okay. I really appreciate it.
I will. Absolutely. So
thank you.
Merry Christmas to everyone out there. And, you know, who knows, maybe we'll cross paths with some people out there in the future.
Very good. Thank you so much. Stay safe. Have a real meaningful holiday, Jason. Thank you.
Thank you. You too. Good night.
All right. Bye-bye. There you have it, Mr. Jason Redman. You can get over to his personal website as well. That's jasonredmanww.com. jasonredmanww.com. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Another great show. Just a real inspiration. Jason Redman. Really brings focus to the sacrifices that our military make just to keep us safe and really to have a lot of freedoms that we have, even to have a radio show. We couldn't do it without those people and all the sacrifices for all the years. Thanks to all the guests that have been on the show, all the guests that are coming up, and all the listeners. We couldn't do it without you. Get over to the website, tremendousliferadio.com. Until next time, make it a great day.